tempo. Ora men de gosa. Ja, kan du sjekke om du får den på Nå går det bra. Yeah.
And they look identical to me. It's because they are done. This is from Hoke's computer at home. The keystrokes you're seeing are passwords used to tap into Hoke's biometrics files.
Oh, hvis jeg snakker, hører du det?
Hoke was dead.
Okay.
This is from Hoke's computer workstation at the Lormy Group. Maida.
Maida. Yes.
Er det for det?
Ja, den kan du ha tilbake. So, from today you will have me as the as a teacher. Hagun will come back once to have a lecture on voice recognition. But I will take the most part from now. So, I guess we should officially... So today I will say something about keystroke dynamics. I will try to have two breaks in between. I think I try to keep it a bit shorter, so... Anyway. Okay, keystroke dynamics. This is what I will talk about. I will give a background first. I will talk about different kinds of keystroke dynamics because you can apply it in multiple ways. We look at the features that we can extract. Then we go into template creation, actually not so much into template updating. I'll just mention it briefly. Performance analysis, of course, important. And then we'll look a bit about the security in typing mimicking. And then some language-related issues as well as, I will give you some applications. I will point to some applications. But first, the background. Keystroke dynamics refers to analysis of the way that I type on a keyboard. And we use that to identify or authenticate a user. See, let me try to get this up. There it is. Typing rhythm is mainly based on experience. You notice that when you started typing, it was two fingers, and you get more and more fluent. Yeah, and once you have a sufficient experience, your typing rhythm might change a bit, but not drastically. Also, external circumstances will play a role, of course. If there is disturbing music around, you will type differently. If there is, if you broke a finger, and a finger or maybe a hand is impaired, your typing will be different. So there are some external, if you change your keyboard, your typing might change. So external circumstances play a role, but the major role is played in by the experience. So here we have what is often considered as the first paper on keystroke dynamics by Gaines and some of his colleagues, and authentication by keystroke timing, some preliminary results, is from 1980. It's a round report, and it is often referenced in literature. They used six experienced typists, so six professional typists, data typists in those days, on a computer, and they had them type three different kind of text. One with an ordinary English text, yeah, where it's easy, there is a sentence and there is a flow in the story. Then random English words, so the one word and the next word don't need to have a specific relation, and then random phrases, yeah, to see if there was differences in the way that these texts were typed. Anyway, their conclusion was that these typists had a distinguishable style of typing. Yeah, obviously, there are only six participants. Yeah, I always give the example, if I do gait recognition, and I walk and a 2-year-old baby is walking, yeah, sure, I can distinguish that. If those are the only participants, I get perfect performance. So six typists is not that much, but all of them were professional typists. So yeah, we can expect from each of them that they are rather fluent in typing. Anyway, they could distinguish that, but it was the first... It was the first real research, and it says in the title also some preliminary results, and many results have followed after. But this was actually not the first time that keystroke dynamics was published. 5 years earlier, Spillane published just this part. That's all. He mentioned there that it might be possible to recognize a typist on a keyboard based on timing information and pressure information. It was published just to make sure that that's what I said. It was no testing of the technique. It was only just published. The idea was published to prevent that some company could take a patent on this. So IBM was apparently IBM was doing this apparently to make sure that other companies could not take patents on a particular ID and so that they could use it afterwards also. He did not do any testing, he just described the ID that it might be possible. That was 5 years before that. And we go back to ancient history, because actually that was not the first thing that you can relate to keystroke dynamics. This is a paper from 1897 that actually describes the idea of keystroke dynamics by a professor, Brian, and a Mr. Harder. So he was not an academic. But they looked at the distinctive typing patterns of telegraph operators. They didn't have keyboards then. They had normal typing machines, but they didn't have keyboards, but they had telegraph machines. For those who don't know that, those are these things. There is a telegraph key here, and so somebody was tapping on that, and you tap in dots and in dashes. So a short tap is a dot, and a long tap is a dash. And then on the that signal was transmitted to the other side, and then either you had an audio signal, but most likely you had that the signal was punched into some kind of tape. Yeah, and on the tape you could see the dashes and the dots. And then you could read it back. You could read the message back.
Yeah, I know this Morse operator stated here, which of their buddies were typing based on the signature.
That's exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
But this is very interesting research, so that's why I want to say a bit more about that. The typing was done in Morse code, as you said. American Morse code in this case, which is slightly different from the European one. They're slightly different codings, but for example, what the Americans had was inside the word they sometimes had a longer space, which is something that in the European did not occur. So we had an I, for example, with two dots, and you had the O also with two dots, but with a longer space in between.
Yeah, the European was slightly different. Anyway, it's still dots and dashes.
This is the message that I had to send.
Okay. You should be able to translate that.
Starts with a lot of dots. The three is dots is an S, and then we have the H, and then an I, two dots without a space, and then the P, five dots. So ship, and then this is numbers 364. Ship.
Well, I have the text here. Ship 364 wagons via Erie Quick. And that was the meaning. It's still an English sentence. But the message was chosen in such a way that there was a particular difficulty.
The first word with just dots is difficult because, yeah, you have to start counting the six here, six dots.
They noticed that operators made also mistakes in counting the number of dots they had sent already, etc.
Then here there is a, in wagons, there is a
combination of dots and dashes. Altogether, they had 75 characters. Yeah, of those, there were 14 dashes and 61 dots.
And a character that had dot and dash only, so a character is just a dot or a dash.
So each message was 75 characters long. They had 60 operators participating in the data collection, but they only analyzed the data of 16 because it was analyzed by hand. And you'll get an impression of what that meant in a second. That message, ship 364 wagons via Erie Quick, that was repeated 8 times by each of these operators. And then you get tape like this. This is not the message, this is not a message, but you get a message like this. And you see there are small differences in...
Zoom in a bit. Wait. That's not zooming in, there it is. There are small differences between dashes and dots every time. So here is a very small dot and here is a bit longer dot. So. Yeah, there is some variability. We know that that normally happens.
And then what they had this tape, and then this this harder looked at the tape and started measuring the tape by hand. They didn't have, they're looking at timing information, but they didn't have a clock and went too fast to measure anything by clock. But they started measuring, and so every character that you have has a beginning and an end. And so they measured where the beginning and the end was. And obviously if you start at the first dot, because I start with a dot, the beginning of the first dot, that was taken as time 0. And then the end of the first dot was time 1. Or they measured how long it was, time t1, I should say. Then the beginning of the second dot and the end of the second dot, that's time t2 and t3, etc., etc. And so 75 characters, they have, in principle, 150 values, except the first value was set to 0. So they have 149 distances to measure. The end of the first dot, the beginning of the second dot, the end of the second dot, the beginning of the third dot. So that's, and they did that by hand. And they measured to the nearest half millimeter. So quite accurate. The tape was running at 47 millimeters per second. So half a millimeter would then be 10.6 milliseconds. 47 millimeters per second, that's... You have an idea of how much that is? Yeah, but... Yeah, okay. In an hour, that's almost 17 kilometers. So 17 kilometers of tape per hour. That's the speed of the tape. Anyway, if you saw what he had to do, he just analyzed the data of 16 operators. They had 8 repetitions of that sentence. They had 149 measurements to do per repetition. So that's 19,000 measurements that he had to do by hand. You can imagine that he didn't analyze all 60 of them. That would be 4 times as much. There were actually more measurements because, as I said, there was difficulty in the text that they had to type. So the 6 was 6 dots. Yeah, people were making mistakes. They had 5 dots or 7 dots or whatever. And so the total number of measurements that he actually had to do was, well, around 20,000, a little over 20,000. Quite impressive. Then if you look at the results, because he did analysis on that data, normally standard it would be the average length of a dot. If I set that to 1 unit, then a dash will be 3 units long. And the space within the dots and dashes within one letter would be one unit long. But if a long space, because it's American Morse code, a long space was there also, that was 2 units long. Space between letters is again 3 units, and between words is 6 units long. And then if you look at the results that they measured, so first of all, he had to do all these measurements, and then he had to do all the statistics on that. So he was one of the operators also. If you look at a particular one, if we set again for this person the length of his average dot to 1, then the length of that average dot was 1.95, so approximately 2 times as long as a dot, instead of the standard 3. But that's possible. That's not a big deal. And so you get different persons, different measurements. If you look at them, you can imagine that you can distinguish between persons. Yeah. If I look at all of these things, very short for this particular person, so we had a total instead of, if I would have all of these characteristics, a total of 9.5 instead of 16. Here is somebody with a total of 20, which is, you can see as the general typing speed of that person is much lower than from the other person. In units of a dot of that person, of course. So it seems that we can distinguish between persons. So some of the conclusions that they drew, every operator develops a distinctive style, and it can be recognized by, obviously, people that work with him a lot. Yeah, so if you hear the typing of a person a lot, then you can, at some point, recognize, if you hear the typing, that it is this particular person. Mr. S, they use terms like this. Mr. S is apparently working with a lot of operators under him, and he could recognize many of them, and also relatively fast. So 4 or 5 words was enough for him to recognize, to identify a person. And identification in biometrics means that I don't know what the identity of the person is, but I determine the identity based on the data that I get. Or I determine that it is not one of the persons that I know, which is in this case also the case, yeah, if it's not one of his men. Very interesting. Many dispatchers claim that they can generally recognize a woman by the style of her sending. So apparently there is a difference between men and women sending data. So that was 1897. This research took a couple of years. Actually, I think they started in 1894. But you can imagine that measuring to half a millimeter accuracy of approximately 20,000 measurements takes quite a while. Some less ancient history, let's say in between Spillane and these guys, or the other way around, in between these guys and Spillane, there was the Fist of the Sender, so that refers to what you were saying. Also telegraph operators, this is in World War II, the English telegraph operators could actually recognize the German operator. They didn't know the German operator, but they could distinguish between the German operators in the troops. Yeah, so if they hear it, they could recognize which of the operators it was. But the Germans, obviously, they were traveling with the troops and they were sending information out. That was not open information. That was, of course, encoded with the Enigma before they were sending it by telegraph. Yeah, and at the other receiving end, it was decoded again. So the message by itself, that was unreadable for the English. But what they used is the fact that the telegraph operator was assigned to a specific troop. And so based on where the signal was coming from and the operator that they were recognizing, they could follow the moving of the troops. And so they did not have the message by themselves, but they had information from this signal. Okay. Then a bit newer. This is turn off the light. This is from the series Numbers. This is a mathematician who has a brother in the FBI, and he is always solving all these crimes. And often it is nice if you see something on television that you know about, so you can determine all the errors that are in there. But it's quite accurate. You will also notice that he will say something about the fist of the sender. Let me see. The question at the end for you will be find the biometric error. So pay close attention. I hope you can hear it. That's not what I want. So there is an error, but that's not the error.
You know what I think he did? Alright, so what were we looking at? Digital representations and patterns of keystrokes. One taken from Hulk's computer at home, one from Hulk's computer at work. Now, you know that experts can distinguish one person's typing from another by their rhythm.
Yeah, you mean like Morse code?
Right. Telegraph operators used to recognize each other by the different ways they used to tap into the exact same codes. Like a concert piece. Originate from the sheet music, the way she plays them is entirely distinctive. Now, if another pianist sits down to play the same piece of music, the strength of notes, the flourishes and rhythm would make the keystrokes totally different. Now, only by seeing them side by side would you be able to tell they were different.
See, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at these and they look identical to me.
That's because they are, Don. This Hulk's computer at home. The keystrokes you're seeing are passwords used to tap into Hulk's sabermetrics files, made after Hulk was dead. This is from Hulk's computer workstation at the Lorman Group, made after Hulk was dead.
So this is the same person that erased the files.
Could you hear it?
No.
Difficult to hear.
You used the same video when you went over the term papers?
Okay, yeah.
I think we all know the answer.
Okay. He says, they look identical to me. That's because they are identical. They are not identical, of course. Okay. Well, maybe I should not show that video in the introductory course. Okay, so that is an example of keystroke dynamics in movies. Okay, let's have a closer look at what keystroke dynamics can actually do for us. We can use, that's not the good way of showing this, we can use keystroke dynamics to get access to a system, so at the start, and there should be a line here to say that you can use keystroke dynamics to reconfirm the identity of a user during a session. There it is. So either we use it to get access or to reconfirm access. Yeah, if I look at a computer, if it's locked, I need to get access, I need to type my password, I'm using the keyboard to type my password. When it is open, I'm still using it, and it would be nice that I can reconfirm the identity such that if I now leave to get a cup of coffee, that you are not using my computer. Yeah? If we look at the first group, to get access, we can actually distinguish between three different types: static authentication, challenge-based authentication, and free text authentication. I will get into them in a second. And for reconfirming the identity, we can look at what is called periodic and continuous authentication. They're very closely related. Let's go into all of these. First, static authentication. As said at the previous slides, uses typing characteristics at the start of a session, or to open a session, let's put it like that. It's called static because there is static information there. We use a fixed password. Your password today and tomorrow will be the same. At some point you might change it, but generally over a long period of time you have the same password. You might look at typing of the username also, but we look at the most important, or the most used in research at least, is looking at how somebody types a password, not so much the username. The fun thing about keystroke dynamics is that we can measure it unobtrusively. I'm typing my password, and I'm checking the password also. It's not that I don't check the value of the password at the end. Yeah, but underneath, I'm also measuring how somebody types. I measure the typing rhythm. Yeah, and besides checking that the person behind the computer typed the correct password, I can use as a second factor, so two-factor authentication, I can use as a second factor the typing rhythm. So we have two-factor authentication by default. You're just doing one thing, but I still have two-factor authentication. It's relatively easy to process the data that I get. Why? Because I know what somebody is going to type, and that person has typed that password a couple of times already, and so I know how he typed that password before, and based on that, I can make a decision on how it is typed this time. Is that comparable to what the person has done before? Relatively easy to process the data because everything is fixed, everything is static. But in this case, it's just the password, just to get access, so there's no detection of a use of changer, a change of user after I've logged on. Yeah? So that's static authentication. Then if we go to challenge-based authentication, we can see what changes. What changes is that the information is now not fixed anymore, but is variable. I get some variable information that I have to present, like a one-time code or one-time PIN code. If you want to get access to your bank, you probably have a small device that will give you a one-time PIN code, and you'll type that PIN code. Or you receive something through your mobile phone, through SMS, and you type that word. It's a given word that you have to type through a second channel. Rest still slightly more difficult. Why? Well, I know how you typed the previous one-time code and the one before that, but that doesn't mean that I know exactly how you'll type this code. If you look at the banking application, you get a six-digit number. Yeah, after I've typed two random six-digit numbers, there will be at least one character that I have typed twice. Maybe more, but at least once that I have typed at least twice. Yeah, so I learned something about that particular character, so if I see it the next time, I know something about it. Yeah, but it takes much longer time to build up knowledge about how a user will type that. So slightly more difficult. Not impossible, but slightly more difficult. If we go to free text authentication, then it's completely free. Still variable, but I can choose whatever. I'll type something, and then based on that, I'll get accepted. So one time I'll type a quote from Shakespeare, and the next time I'll just describe the weather, and then so I can change what I type, but based on that, we give access. And obviously, this becomes more difficult, because there might be people who just sit and type the same key over and over again, and I still have to learn from that. So these were the three methods to get access to a system, and there were two methods to get reconfirmed identity. So periodic authentication is the first, monitors typing behavior during a session. In general, obviously non-fixed text. I'm not repeating today what I've done tomorrow. I don't get very far in my work if I do. So generally, yes, you see things that are repeated. Yeah, I write articles about keystroke dynamics, so the word keystroke will be typed, obviously, a lot of times. But yeah, all around that will be different. So reconfirms the identity of a genuine user, or of the user, current user, I should say, at regular intervals. That's why it's called periodic. So I'll check the identity now, and then I'll wait a bit, and I'll check it again, and I'll check it again. And what that interval is, that can be flexible. I can either say I'll do that once every minute, I'll just watch what you have done in that minute, and I'll, based on that, I will reconfirm the identity. Or I'll wait for 200 keystrokes, and once I have 200 keystrokes, based on how you type those 200 keystrokes, I'll do the check, whatever. Yeah. So you can use both. Generally, if you really link it to time, and say you wait 1 minute, you have no idea what a person might do in 1 minute. He might just have typed 2 or 3 characters because he finished something, and then he could be doing something else, and then the task gets difficult. So in general, what they do is look at a fixed amount of keystrokes that they collect. And then they can, of the keystrokes that you collect, you can do statistical analysis, you can do any kind of analysis. How often did the person use the backspace? How often did the person have a smaller break in between? And he's typing something, and then he takes a break, and then he's typing again. So you can collect some statistics. Obviously, it can be, and it should be, unnoticeable for the user.
Yeah, this machine is protecting me, and so hopefully it doesn't interfere with me. If it would interfere, it could equally well ask for a password every 10 minutes or something like that. Very disturbing. Yeah, but this should be as unnoticeable as possible. And the analysis, in principle, you can compare it to free text, which we had on the slide before. Yeah, we don't know what somebody is doing, but based on whatever he is providing me, I have to make a decision. Still the same user or not. Then if we go to continuous authentication, we'll see that only a few things change. The only thing actually that changes is here. While in periodic, I waited, let's say, 200 keystrokes, and then based on how those 200 keystrokes were typed, I make a decision. Even if I could have said halfway already, if I would have done analysis halfway, I would have locked out a user if I detected that it is not the correct user. I still wait 200 keystrokes, and then I make a decision. And after 200 keystrokes again, I make a decision. So at fixed intervals. Here, in principle, I should be able to determine after each and every single keystroke, this is the correct user, he can continue or not. That is obviously not based on that single keystroke. That is based on that single keystroke plus the history that I have. If I see that somebody is very good at typing in the way that I would type, so then it's probably me, and all of a sudden one key is typed very strangely. Yeah, that doesn't lock me out. But if everything is shady already beforehand, there's a lot of deviations already beforehand, and then again I do a mistake, yeah, that could be a point where I get locked out. Continuous, and obviously this is the most difficult way of analysis because I can hardly do statistical analysis on a single keystroke. I can't combine it also, but this is more difficult than the previous one. Continuous authentication will be a topic in 2 weeks' time, I believe. We'll go into that then. There is one concept which is called active authentication. It's more or less the same as continuous authentication or periodic. Those terms are used interchangeably. Active authentication comes from the DARPA, the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which you probably know. They built the internet in the beginning. And active authentication is defined as a continuous authentication solution that takes the data available on a DoD computer in this case and makes an informed decision on the identity of the user of the computer. Actually, it doesn't make an informed decision on the identity. It just determines if it's the genuine user or not. That's all that it does. And actually, here's a link. If you follow that link, you'll see the title of a let's say, a commercial an announcement where they have as a title, "Where DARPA is going, you don't need passwords." That's a bit over the top, in my opinion, because how would that work? I turn on the computer, it's open, and only after I've done things wrong, it will lock again. That's strange, because then I'll just start it again, and I have access, right? So you still need passwords. Continuous authentication by no means is a replacement for static authentication. It's an addition to that. So you need both. When I say continuous authentication, I always mean either periodic or continuous. Whenever I say static, I'm talking about the other three. And so I use these terms very loosely. I need to say something about data collection. Because we're doing experiments on keystroke dynamics and we have to collect data. And in case of static, so when it's related to password to get access, or in case of continuous authentication, these things might be different. So in case of static authentication, we have to select if we use in an experiment, if everybody will type the same password, so one password for all, or if everybody has his own password. 9 out of 10 cases, you will see that research has done this case. One password for all, which is great. Because if we all type the same password, then the way I type that password and the way you type that password is very easy to compare. Yeah? Although you are trying to be like you and I'm trying to be like me. So you can see this as a zero effort attack.
Yeah, he's trying to type like himself, but I still compare it to my way of typing. He's not actively trying to mimic me. One password per person is obviously more realistic in a real life scenario. Everybody has his own password, although some passwords are used by many people, but they are not that strong. One password per person means that I can type my password a lot of times, you type your password a lot of times, but then when we start comparing, yeah, then everything fails because the way you type your password and the way I type my password is different because they're different passwords. So in that case, you have to make sure that if everybody has his own password, I still type the passwords of other people also. Which means that I collect less data of other people typing my password. If everybody types the same password, if we all type a password 100 times, then in this case I would have five attackers. So I have 500 passwords to attack passwords compared to my template, my reference. Yeah, if everybody types his own password, but once in a while also my password, yeah, then I have less data. But it's more realistic from a real case scenario. In continuous and periodic authentication, what you often see is that people get a copying task. Or they get a restriction to what applications they use. You have to use Word and you have to type something. Yeah, or you have to use Word and you have to copy something, or Notepad, or whatever. Or it could be completely unrestricted. Yeah, just do whatever you want. You want to use Word? Great. You want to use PowerPoint? Great. If you want to use Internet? Great. Yeah. There is difference. Copying task is a inherently different thing than free typing. So if you ever read something about continuous authentication and you see that the task that the person had is copying information, then that is different from... You behave different from when you are normally using your computer. Not everybody agrees on that. I've seen research where they have shown that there are similarities. But I have also had my own research where I actually made the mistake in continuous authentication that for enrollment, we had people copy a text, and then for the testing, we had data from using the computer for 3, 4, 5 days. And there was no match between that. So the way that they looked at this particular text that they had to copy and the way that they normally would use a computer was unrelated. Very bad results. And we threw that part away. We just took one of these 5 days that they used the computer freely and made a reference template from that and compared it to the other 4 days. We got good results. Restriction to some application will tell you something about how people will use a particular application and how we can distinguish between people when they are using that application. Again, that doesn't mean that whatever I do on my computer, I can distinguish people. Completely unrestricted, of course, gives you the best results for real life, but it's much more difficult to get data there. We have data. We have 50-something people that we installed an application, and we said, just use your computer for a week, and then whatever you do, we will log that, and we will get that data. Yeah. Obviously, much more difficult to get participants for that, because in principle, I can browse through that file and see what you have done. It's a file with many hundred thousands of lines, so I won't do that, even if I would like, but it's nearly impossible. But yeah, it's difficult. This is something that you can simply say, okay, sit here, my computer, do this task. Or your own computer. That's one other thing that we have to consider. In general, for both static and periodic. Are we restricting hardware? Or are we restricting the environment? Or maybe not. So, if we are all using our own computer, and I determine that there is different way of me typing on my computer and you typing on your computer, is that because your computer plays a big role, or just because our typing is different? On the other hand, if we say, we'll forget about the factor of computer, everybody uses the same computer, yeah, sure, this is my computer. I'm used to typing on this computer. You might not be. Maybe the layout of the keys will be the same, but the sizes of the computer are different and whatever. Yeah? So both of them have advantages and disadvantages. Okay. Let me quickly start with some features that we can collect in keystroke dynamics. This we mentioned before already, timing information. Actually, when we type a letter, we're doing two things. We're taking two actions. Every time that we type a letter, we have two actions. We press the key down, and we release it. And I can measure when the key is pressed down, and I can measure when it's released. Exactly the same as Brian and Harter, they could measure where a dot started and where a dot ended. That was related to the time when the telegraph key was pressed down and when the telegraph key was released. So we have key down time and key up time. I use down and press interchangeably, and I use up and release interchangeably. I try to stick to one terminology, but that's difficult. So timing information is something that we can collect. We can collect, as Spillane said in his 75 release already, we can look at pressure. Obviously, timing information I can collect on my machine. I just hook into the operating system and that will give me the... I use software and that will give me the information. Force, yeah, I can't measure force on a normal keyboard. I need a special keyboard for that. But if you measure force, and there is some research on using, including force when typing, you can detect much better the identity of a user. We can look at sound. Sound generated by the keyboard when typing, that is again personal. We've done some experiments here also where we were typing in an otherwise silent room, so it was not that realistic setting, but at least it was preliminary research. Somebody was typing a simple password, and we were collecting the timing information, we were collecting the sound information, and I have to think very hard. When we were doing authentication, the timing information gave me much better results than the audio information. When we were doing identification, the audio information gave me much better results than the timing information. Very interesting. Yeah, and for sound, well, if I have a laptop, there is a microphone in the laptop anyway. So I can collect that relatively easy. What finger is used to type what letter or what key on the keyboard? Am I using two fingers? Yeah, am I typing the A with my left index finger? Or am I using my ring finger there? Yeah, that will give you some information. If I'm using my left index finger, probably I'm using two fingers, and yeah, that will not be an experienced typist. So I can distinguish between people there also. Again, I need some special equipment. I need probably a camera or something that can capture this information, and if I'm using a camera anyway, why not point it up to the face? Then I get other information that I could use. Anyway, I can collect this kind of information. Probably I can collect more information also. But these are some potential features, but we'll focus anyway on timing information only because it's the majority of the research is focusing on that, and it's so easy to collect this information. So what we measure is actually when a key is pressed down, referred to as the press time or the key down time or the down time or whatever you want. I tried to stick to press time in this presentation, but I'm not sure if I manage. The time that the key is released is the release time or the key time, key up time or the up time or whatever. Yeah. That's the raw data that I'm collecting. When I'm typing, that's the information I collect. When did I press the key down? When did I release the key? From that, I'm going to calculate the number of features that I will use in the analysis later on. First feature is duration. That is actually the time that a key is held down. So I start pressing a key, and then I release it. How long was that key down? Again, in terms of Brian and Harter, how long was that dot or that dash? You could measure that. So the length
of the time interval from pressing down a key to releasing it. In literature, if you read literature, you will also see hold time or dwell time. Hold time, obviously, that's keys held down. Then the other thing that we look at is latency. That's the time between actually releasing one key and going to the next key. If you're thinking about typing with one finger, that makes sense. I press one key, and then when I release it, I'm not using the keyboard, I'm moving to the next key, which I press then. So latency will say something about the time that the keyboard isn't used. If I'm using 10 fingers, obviously that's less obvious. So the time between releasing one key and pressing the next key. Also called fly time, if you think of this in the analogy of one finger. My finger is flying from one key to the next one. Now, how long does that take? Note that latency can be negative. If we type fast, probably we're pressing the next key already before we're releasing the previous key, the first key. Not a big deal. We can handle negative numbers, right? Yeah. So if the second key is pressed before the first key is released, we just get a negative value for latency if we define it as the time that the second key is pressed minus the time that the first key is released, which is after that case, and so I get a negative value. Not everybody liked negative values for latency for some reason, and so there were alternative definitions for latency. So we call the release press latency as a latency I just defined. But alternatively, I can have the PP latency, press latency. Pressing one key, pressing the next key. Obviously, that is a positive value. I cannot press the second key before I press the first key. I can do that, but then the first key is called second key and vice versa. So that is always a positive value. I can define the release latency, releasing one key and releasing the second key. But now I get the problem again, that can be negative. Think about when you type a capital, for example. You press down the shift key, you press the let's say the A, and then normally you could say, I release the A and I release the shift key. So depending on how you release them, I get a positive or a negative RR latency. I get anyway a negative RP latency, because I can't release the shift key before I have pressed the A in this case. Yeah, and here if I release the shift first and then release the A, I get a positive latency. If I release the A first and then the shift, I get a negative RR latency. And then the last one is press release latency. But note here, that is not press and release of one key, because that was the duration, the whole time. That's the press of the first key all the way up to the release of the second key. And again, this is positive. Why? Before I release the second key, I must have pressed the second key. And so it will certainly be more than the PP latency, which was positive already. So the PR latency will be positive also. Graphically, it looks like this. I type AB, so I press A, and I release A, I press B, and I release B, and these are the latencies. This, whenever I say latency, that's the one I need. I mean. Let me do one more slide before we have a short break, because we have now a number of definitions of latency. If you would see this and this picture, yeah, know that this is the whole time of the duration of the A and this is the duration of the B. Would you agree that RP latency is the more natural one to use? In principle, I can calculate the other latencies from these values. So the PP latency is related to this RP latency plus the duration of this key. And the RR latency is, well, again, this RR is here, so the RP latency plus the duration of the B. And similar, the PR latency is just the sum of all three. Yeah, what is the advantage of the first one? It's always positive, because I can only press the second key after the first. The second one can be negative. Yeah, in this particular example that I explained already. And the third one is again positive. Yeah, but you can claim that if I use duration and let's say PP latency, then a variation in the duration will automatically be a variation in the PP latency. So these are not independent values. Okay. Let's have a 10-minute break. Let's start again at 10:15. It's slightly over 10 minutes. Okay, any questions so far, by the way? Okay, good. Then let's have a break.
Yes, skal vi fortsette? Ok, good. So that's where we ended up the last time. So that in principle doesn't really matter what latency you use, you can always derive other latencies from that. Even if I would use PP latency, I can find the RP latency again from that. Yeah. So let's look at the data collection. Yeah, we're collecting information about timing information about typing the keys. And so, as I said, there are two actions that somebody can do. I can press a key or I can release a key. So we should note that whenever I record some time, if it was a press action or a release action, obviously I should record the time and the value. I should record which key I just typed. Why is that? Because I type different keys in different ways. So if I type AB and I press down the A key at time T1 and I release it at time T2, and then for B it's time T3 and T4, then I should collect something like the press at T1 of the key A and the release at time T2 of the A. So this is raw data that you can collect. It can look slightly different, but this is the essence. And so from that, I can calculate durations, and I can calculate latencies. And if you want, you can also store something like the next key, because the latency is a feature of two keys, so between one key and the next key. In principle, that next key is displayed here also. And obviously, when I have typed my last key, there is no more latency, because I release that key here, but then there is no press of another key. And so I can't calculate that latency value. So what happens actually? Now we're looking at static authentication, so we're typing a password, and I'll type a number of keys. And my password by no means is n characters long in this particular case, because I could use shift key or control key or whatever in between. So that is also one of the keys that, if I use it, will be in here. These are the physical keys that I press on the keyboard. And I can measure the timing for each of these n keys that I press, that I use. I can measure when I press them down, and I can measure when I release it. So I get TIP and TIR. And from that, I can easily calculate then the duration of each of the n keys by subtracting from the release time the press time. That's the time interval, the length of the time interval that I kept the key down. And the latency between a key and the next key, I can simply measure by subtracting from the time that I pressed the second key, the time that I released the key before that. And obviously, that can only be calculated if this key I plus 1 exists. Yeah, at the very end, when I have the latency n minus 1, I can calculate, because that is the press time of the nth key minus the release time of the n minus first key. But the next one I can't calculate. So you're in a table, you get something like this. Again, the next key at the end is not really relevant because that column is the same as this part. So that one removed. So that's not really extra information. And I can just call them DI and LI. And you see that I have n durations and I have n minus 1 latencies. So if I use n keys, I get n durations and I get n minus 1 latencies. Sometimes the format is different. I said before that we collected this continuous data for continuous authentication. Actually, we collected also mouse information and much more. And so you see that we had a row number, and then we had an activity or a type of action, which was K for keystroke, M for mouse, and some more. And then a key could be pressed down or released, so up, down, and up. The value was here. Welcome 42 apparently was typed.
and then the timing information, and then there was a relation between a previous key. That is often handy because I have here an up of the E, and it says here 80, and that's related to this 80. So it's related to this down of the E, and not to this one up here. Software is not perfect, so sometimes it did not record something. If this the up of the E was not recorded, at some point I'm sitting with a down of an E, which doesn't have an up, and so when I'm looking for an up of that E, and I find this one, I can't link it to that one. I have to link it to this one. This was software that was developed here at the college. And simply here, so you have the key down and the key up of a particular letter M, and so easy to calculate. If I look at the timing values, easy to calculate the duration by subtracting the first from the second. And latencies here, you see that we here have a case where I press the E already before I release the W, so I get a negative latency here. And so the latency between the E and the, between the W and the E is this minus this. But this minus a larger value, which is obviously negative. Yeah, so the format in which the raw data comes is not that important. The fact that we can calculate duration and latency from that is obvious. Okay, so we can collect timing information. We can calculate durations and latencies. And so we have to now look at how we're going to create a template, reference template, because we need a reference to later use to compare. So a reference template is always based on initial typing. Yeah, like in a fingerprint or in a face recognition system, first we enroll into the system, and then we're going to use the system. So the first fingerprint image that I give is used as enrollment. Reference template is created from that. So same here. You can't enroll later on. You just enroll in the beginning, and then you use the template, the reference template later on. But if I just give you a new random password, or you come up with a new random password, and you have to start typing that, yeah, that might be odd. In a sense, you're not familiar. You're looking for the keys. If I write down a completely random password, and you have to type that, yeah, that will not be fluent at all. So you're unfamiliar with that. And the typing rhythm in the beginning may display large variations when you type it multiple times. So we have to come up with a solution for that. Also, in face recognition, in fingerprint, and in biological biometrics in general, you use a sample to create a reference template. Use a fingerprint or image of the face or whatever. Yeah. In behavioral biometrics, that's not that easy. I can't type the password one time and then assume that that is representative for my way of typing. There is a lot of intra-person variation in behavioral biometrics. And so what we do in behavioral biometrics is we record the typing of, in this case, a password various times. And based on that, somebody types a password 10 times, and based on those times, I find the average way that this particular user types his password. In case of a completely new random password, we might consider not taking the first few times that a person types a password, because that might not be representative. When a person gets used to it, it might change a lot. This is actually the only thing that I have about updating. So, updating in the content was not that good. What we could do, we know that the behavior changes slightly over time, so we get more and more used to typing a password, so we get more and more fluent. And so the way that I typed the password in the very beginning, even if I ignored something from the very early typings of the password, might not represent how I type the password in 3 months from now. So what we could do is update the template over time such that it stays in line with the changes, with the natural changes that when the user is learning to type this password.
Yeah?
I'm thinking that over time, when you write a password, it goes from being that password with those characters to actually being a template inside your brain for those movements. So you don't even need to remember the password anymore. You can still write it.
If somebody asked me what my password is, I really have to think about the password. I really have to think how I type it. It's not natural anymore to just say it.
And that probably takes at least 100 times.
Oh, probably, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Good. So people will learn to type a password better after some time, and it gets an automatism at some point. Like walking is an automatism now. You don't think about it anymore, right? And if we look at how a person types a password now and the next time, there will be changes. And the change between, or the difference, let's put it like this, the difference between typing a random password the first time and a second time will be huge. There will be hardly any relation between that. And between the second and the third time, there will also be a big difference. But that difference gets smaller and smaller over time as the user gets used to it. Here is a graph, which simply represents the total time it takes to type a password. And you see that in the beginning, this is the number of times that a password is typed. In the beginning, it is like 16 seconds. And then it goes down. And at some point, you see that it stabilizes. Yeah, but this here, this first part, doesn't represent at all how the user will type the password in the end. It's a bit strange because they end up around, let's say, 4 or 5 seconds to type a password, which I think is long, so I'm not sure what this represents, although it says the entry time in milliseconds. So maybe it's a long password or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, but you see that what is done in the beginning is not representative, and I should just ignore that. I should allow a user to get used to a password before, here it starts stabilizing and it's getting more and more stable over time. At least the total time. I'm not sure how the details inside the password, how those change, but probably they are stabilizing too. Yeah, so we have to consider how long somebody needs for learning. If I give you a password, welcome 42, you don't need a lot of time. Yeah, welcome is a word that you can easily write. And there is this step going over from the E in welcome, last E, to the 4, that might take some hesitation, might take some time to get used to, but we'll do that. Yeah, if I give you a completely random password, period TIE 5 capital RONL, that takes some time to get used to. Yeah. Anyway, so this is in the sense of creating the template, which is created in the beginning. How many times should a person type a password, and how much of that in the beginning we should actually ignore, or maybe not even record. We just let the user type it a couple of times to get used to the password, and then when he says, now I'm used to it, we can start recording. So you might start recording from here on, for example. And you see there might be still things where times when it's a bit odd. Anyway, at some point in time we decided these are the 10 or 20 or whatever times that we'll use to create the template from, and then we have to average in one way or another. So the password is typed k times in this case, capital K. And so each duration and latency, I have k times. The duration of the first letter, I have k times. The latency between the first and the second, I have k times. The duration of the second, I have k times. And then when I'm averaging, I'm not taking the average of the first duration and the second duration. No, I'm taking the average of all the first durations, all these k values, and all these first k latencies. All these k first latencies, and all these k second durations. Yeah, so if I have a table, I have the first duration, and first time, and first duration, the second time, and a first duration, the third time, etc., k times. I have the second duration, k times, etc., and I have n durations,
I'll just ignore the latencies for now for this setup. Yeah, so I typed the password of n characters. And I have so n duration the first time that I typed it, n duration the second time that I typed it, n duration the third time that I typed it. Then when I do the averaging in this way. So I get an average here, and I get an average here, over this column, and I all the way up here. And so know that I'm not averaging something of one time of typing the password, I'm averaging over the times that I typed the password. So in this case, I have the durations, I have all of the n durations, I have k times. And all of the n minus 1 latencies, each of them, I also have k times. And then what I simply do is I'll take the average of this di, these k di values. And I call that capital Di. And I'll do that for all the d values and similarly for all the latencies. I didn't say what average meant. So what is average? Well, it could be the mean of these values, or the median of these values. Or I could do something with which is called outlier removal. So mean with outlier. Let's look at what that is. Suppose I have a number of values. Yeah, now it's just mathematics for a second. I have a number of values, I have n values, and they are ordered in some way. This is not important, but it's easier to explain what the median is. But first, the mean. The mean of these values is just adding them all up and dividing by the number of values that I have. That's a concept you know. And related to the concept of mean is the concept of standard deviation. It's looking at each value, how much it varies, how far it is away from the mean value. And I square all these differences. And then I'll take the average of that summation. And then I actually have this summation divided by n is the variance. The standard deviation is the square root of the variance. So actually this summation divided by n, that is the variance, sigma squared. So the standard deviation I get by taking the square root. So I can calculate mean and standard deviation very easily. I can calculate median also. Median just says I look at the value which is in the middle. There are equally many values larger as they're smaller. That's what I do. So if I have an odd number of values, I'll just take the one which is in the middle. That's why I ordered, which would be then easier to describe this. If I have an even number, then actually I don't have a number in the middle, but I have one which is, two values that are near the center. I'll just take the average of those two. That's a plus. I'll change that. Yeah? So mean, standard deviation, median, you all know that, right? That's nothing new here. Both of them have their merits. Median can handle outliers better. Let's suppose that I have these first n minus 1 values are close together, and this one is all of a sudden a big value. Yeah, then suppose in terms of if we talk about latencies, normally I type the password quite fluent, so all the latencies for, let's say, the first latency is all the same. But one time I typed the first letter, and then I hesitated, and then I continued. So that latency between the first and the second letter in that case will be very large compared to the normal time. That's what we call an outlier, a non-standard value. And I should remove it. Median handles it by, just saying it's a value larger than the median. Doesn't matter if it's way larger or not. So median handles outliers better, but mean is a better measure of central tendency. But in case of that outlier, that will have a large impact on the median. So what we want to use is mean, but we want to have the influence of the outliers smaller. So in statistics, an outlier is an observation point that is distant from other observations. I have a number of observations that are close together, and then I have an observation there. And that's clearly something that we say that's what we want to ignore. Yeah, and in case of the median, I just say these two, Yeah, I'll just work to the middle. There was another value here, so I have another number of values and say this is the mean. The median, sorry. In case of the mean, I'll add up all these values and then this will play a major role. And obviously if I have a huge number of values, the outlier will have less influence, but if I have just a small number of values, will have a larger influence. So it depends how often I ask somebody to type a password and how many outliers I have. So what we prefer to do is remove these outliers. Well, what we can first do is delete obvious values. If I'm looking at, for example, latencies, and if I pause in between typing, yeah, then it's clear I get a very large latency. I get a latency which is more than 1 second, or even more than 2 seconds, or whatever. I set some boundary and I say if the latency is more than 1.5 seconds, I'll just ignore it. That's strange. Somebody was absent-minded. He didn't continue typing in a regular manner. So I can ignore everything that is more than some boundary that I set, 2 seconds, 1 second, whatever. If you look at these values, latencies are generally in the order of below 1 second, well below 1 second. Once you start using shift key, yeah, then the latencies might go up. But in between the T and the H, for example, the latency is in general very small. Around 0.2, 0.1, something like that. So something more than 2 seconds is out of the ordinary. I'll just ignore everything. And here is another value that I was. So here was this boundary, and I'll ignore that value anyway. But this one is also an outlier, apparently. I maybe want to remove that too. So how do I do that? After I remove the obvious outliers, what I'll do is I'll calculate the mean and the standard deviation of whatever is remaining. So I look at these values, and I calculate mean and standard deviation. And the mean is, for example, the mean is here. And I calculate the standard deviation. And now, what I will do in the second step is I remove everything that is a number of standard deviations away. Let's say, for example, that I remove everything that is more than 2 standard deviations away. So what I'll do is, from this mean, I look at 2 standard deviations this way, and I look at 2 standard deviations this way, and everything that falls outside this boundary, I remove. I remove this one, and this one in this case. Those are atypical values. And if you look at that, that sounded atypical also. But I'm left with a smaller set, which is hopefully more consistent. If I removed values here in this step, what I'll do is I have to, because now the set is different, so I have to, the mean and the standard deviation that I calculated before are not representing the new set. I have to calculate it again, and then I can remove values again. So maybe because I removed the mean, I removed one large value and one which was slightly... So maybe the mean now is slightly smaller. There. This is a new mean value. Standard deviation has certainly become smaller, because values far away have a large impact on the standard deviation. Yeah, so maybe now 2 standard deviations is this. And I can remove again. And I can repeat this until I did not remove anything. Because if I didn't remove anything and I would go back, I calculate the same mean and I calculate the same standard deviation, and still everything would be within this boundary of k standard deviations from the mean. So I get it in an endless. So at some point I stop. What could be stop criteria? I could just stop if indeed nothing is removed. But I run the risk, because here you see that maybe all of these values could be okay. Here I'm still removing some values. Because the standard deviation has become small, I'm now looking at a more narrow interval around the new mean. And I remove some values. And then, yeah, it has again become more consistent. The values have become more consistent, so the standard deviation gets smaller again. And I start removing everything, which we should not do. So we could stop when everything is within the range, but that might remove too many values. So we could do this a maximum number of times. Yeah, fixed number of times. Right now, fix maximum number of times is actually. I say that I do this at most 5 times, this loop. But if after the 3rd time no values are removed, then the last couple of loops are not doing anything. Right? So I do it at most 5 times unless it's the process stops earlier. I could do, what I could also do is I keep doing this until I notice that the number of values that are remaining are becoming too small. Okay, then if I want to do statistics, I want to do statistics over a significant number of values. If I'm doing statistics over a small number of values, yeah, then the resulting mean and standard deviation become meaningless at some point in time. Yeah, so I'll see, okay, I still have 20 values left. Well, that's okay, I'll do another step. And then I only have 15 values left. Okay, then I'll stop because I want at least 15 values. Yeah, so there are different ways. There are many ways of doing outlier removal. This is a way of doing it. There are different ways also. Could be part of the analysis to see which outlier removal gives you the best result. So after we have done whatever way of creating the template, we have a template, right? If that contains the mean or the median or the mean with outliers or whatever, or including the standard deviation with the mean, I don't care. But we have a template now. So we have a reference template and we have a probe. And now we have to see if the probe matches the reference template. So we have to do performance analysis. So here we have our reference template, the average way of typing the password of a particular person, and we have a probe from the same or from another person, and these are average values. This is just how I just typed this password. That gives me a number of durations, and that gives me a number of latencies, and that's it. One time go. I type the password one time. I don't do any averaging. I just get a set of durations and a set of latencies, and I have to calculate the distance. The distance between the reference and the probe. So here is a very simple distance metric. Just take the absolute value. I see this duration of the first key, and I know what I expected, the average way that the genuine user did this, and this is how it's done now. And so what I look at is how far are they apart in absolute value, and that will be in addition to the distance. Yeah. And then I'll do that for the second, all the way up to the last, and then I'll do the same for all the latencies. And I look at all the differences of what I got in the probe when I just typed the password and what I expected according to the reference. I look at all these differences in absolute value. I'll add them up and I get a distance. That's a good distance? I don't know. We can test that. This is called the Manhattan distance, or absolute distance. Anybody know why this is called Manhattan distance? You know how Manhattan is built? All the avenues and all the streets? Yeah, that's all very square. And now if I have to go from there to there, I'll just count how many blocks I have to go in this way and how many blocks I have to go in this way. And I'll add those up. Yeah, now I have two dimensions. There I have 2n+1 dimension. Yeah, that's the reason. So Manhattan distance or absolute distance. If we look at this a bit better, here we have everything again. If we look at this, actually it was based on, I'm not sure why it's doing that. It's always messing this up. It's the part of the distance was based on the durations and part of the distance was based on the latencies. Yeah, so the part that was based on the durations is just the sum of these end values. And the part that's based on the latency is just based on these n minus 1 values. And actually, yes, we can calculate durations and we can calculate latencies, but that doesn't mean that we have to use them in the analysis. Think about fingerprint again, when Christoph said that every minutia has a location and has a direction and has a type. Type was often not used in the analysis.
So here we don't have to do that either. So we can select if we maybe only want to have durations or maybe only want to use latencies. What could be an advantage of using just durations, or what could be an advantage of using just latencies? Any suggestions? What you'll see, you haven't seen that, but if you read a lot, what you'll see is durations are often more stable in the behavior of a person. So there is less variability in the values of the duration than there is in the values of the latencies. So that might be a reason to use durations, because durations will, if I type my password again, my durations will be close to the durations that are giving me the average from the reference, and so then I will get a small distance. The disadvantage of duration is that everybody is stable and everybody is close together. So the intra-distance, the intra-person distance is smaller, but the interperson distance is also smaller. Yeah, latency has some more variation, so yeah. But also across persons it has more variation. To see what performs best is just a matter of testing. What if I use this? What if I use this? What if I use both? Just test it. We can use other latencies also. Now we're using the release press latency. That's what I'm always talking about. I've seen people that used both release press and press latency and durations. Yes, there is a dependency between these values. That's okay. I don't mind. Yeah. So you can use different or additional latencies also. You can use part of the durations and latencies. Yeah, maybe my password contains a shift key. And I know that if I use a shift key, that the latency between the shift key and the key that I'm actually typing in uppercase, that latency has a lot of variation in it. It's all over the place. Yeah, maybe it's not a good idea to include that, because what additional information could it give me? And so I might, based on the person typing this password, based on the way he does it, make a selection of durations and latency that I want to include in the distance metric. So not just sum over all n durations and n minus one latencies, but take a subset of that in a smart way. I can have a weighted version. So I use duration and latencies both. Originally I said they are equally important. There's a weight of 1 here and a weight of 1 there, but I can have a weight of rho here and 1 minus rho here. So if rho is getting close to 1, I'm more or less looking just at durations. If rho is getting close to 0, I'm just looking at latencies. If rho is 1/2, yeah, I'm weighing them equally. If rho is 1/2, then this one is actually the same as this one. So this one is twice as big as this one. But that doesn't matter. That's a linear scaling of all the distances. So no worries about that. Here's another one. If I look at the durations only, do you type each letter equally often? No. So maybe in this part I want to, now I have a weighing of those two distance parts. Maybe I want to have a weighing inside this duration part. So based on the key that I'm typing, I'm saying that, okay, we weigh this difference in a slightly different way. For example, if I know that I type the E and the R and the N very often, okay, then I want that these play a more important role in the process. So if the key is an E, then this weight should be a bit higher. If this is a J, which we don't use that often, then this weight can be a bit lower. So I don't care that the difference is a bit, because I know that I'm not that stable. Not all letters are typed equally consistent. Well, the consistency we get from the sigma value. We have the mean and the sigma value. The sigma value says something about the consistency. We can measure that there. And what we often do is we assume the duration and latency values for a particular person, of a particular key or a particular set of pair of keys, of course, that those values that are measured have a normal distribution. That's an assumption that's often done. So that the durations of when I type the letter E follow some kind of normal distribution. Obviously, it doesn't do that. Why? This extends to from minus infinity to plus infinity. Well, I will certainly not have a negative duration. Ever. Yeah, so obviously it doesn't follow this, but modeling it with a normal distribution often works pretty well. And in a normal distribution, we know that if we have the mean value, that 68% of all the observations will be at most one standard deviation away from the mean. And 95% will be at most two standard deviations away from the mean. And 99.7% of all observations will be at most three standard deviations away from the mean. So if I all of a sudden notice something that my duration is seven standard deviations away from the mean, that is odd. That is very, very unlikely. Yeah? And we can use that information. So here we have, let's say this is the way that one person types a particular letter, so the duration of, let's say, the E. He has a particular mean time of doing that with a particular standard deviation, and this is from another person. And there is some overlap between those distributions. And so we have to calculate that. We know that that happens. And we see that if we say we allow everything within one standard deviation away from the mean, if we say that this first user is a genuine user, then we also see that all of a sudden there will be some instances of the second person typing the letter E in his normal way that will fall within this range. So where he will get accepted. But that is just one particular key. Yeah, the password has a number of keys in there, n keys, and this is just one duration. Yeah, we have n duration and we have n minus one latency, so we have a lot of value. Yeah, so even though it will be difficult to distinguish between two persons based on a single key, the magnitude of keys will help to build a good system. Very briefly on the meaning of the standard deviation. A small standard deviation means that somebody is very consistent in the way of typing. A large standard deviation means that he is not consistent in the way of typing. So here we have a very narrow distribution. This one has a small standard deviation, meaning all of the values are, in this case, around zero. This is just a graph. The values don't matter that much. That means that the standard deviation is very small. And the blue one, which is very broad, it's a large standard deviation, so the values are all over the place. The typing is less consistent, or the values are less consistent. So now I specified the reference slightly better. For each duration and for each latency, I now don't have just the average value. I really have a mean and a standard deviation. So I keep the standard deviation. I take that into account. And when I do that, I can calculate what is called the scaled Manhattan distance. So it's the same as the Manhattan distance. Yeah, I look at what I expect of a particular duration and the distance to what I see in the probe, or what I expect of a latency and what I see in a probe. But that absolute difference is now all of a sudden divided by the standard deviation for that particular duration or for that particular latency. So for example, if the average is 5, and the measured value is 4, or if the average is, I don't know, 7, and the measured value is 3, which would you think is a better situation? Well, normally you would say, well, here the difference is smaller than here, so this sounds better. Yeah, but here I had a standard deviation of 1, and here I had a standard deviation of, I don't know, 100 for example. Yeah, so the fact that there is a difference of 4 here isn't really very important, because I know that this value varies a lot. Here I know that, let's say, 0.1. I know that 99.7% of all the measurements should be between 4.7 and 5.3, 3 standard deviations away. And so this is a very exceptional value. And so the difference by itself is not so important. The difference in relation to the standard deviation is important. So that's why we came up with this scale Manhattan distance. It's, in principle, it's a very simple distance metric. But this one performs very well in keystroke dynamics. Let's have this now in relation to keystroke dynamics. Here somebody typed the password P7ENE capital ZUH. Because capital Z is shift and the Z key. And here in the beginning we see the durations, and at the end we see the latencies. So have the duration of the P7ENE shift key, which all of a sudden has a large duration. Why? I have to keep it down while I'm typing the Z key. The Z, U, and H, and then we go over to latencies. And you see here a negative latency, which has again to do with the latency between the shift key and the Z key, which is negative. We see here in this graph that, I have to explain the two red lines. The first red line, the one below, is for each of these durations and latencies the mean minus one standard deviation. The top red line is the mean plus one standard deviation. So here we see that these two red lines are very close together. That means that the sigma value, the standard deviation, is very small. Here we see that they are very far apart, which means that the standard deviation, sigma, is very large, because the difference between the top and the bottom red line is 2 sigma in distance. For this particular, in this case, it's a... this one is probably the latency between P and 7. Yeah, so we see what the meaning of sigma is that these two values are very far apart. Sometimes we see that the blue one is a measured, it's a probe. So the two red ones is the reference and the blue one is a probe. And sometimes we see that the blue one is right in between these two red lines, which is great, of course. So very close to the mean value. Here it's slightly below the mean value, here it's more or less on the dot. So that's great. Sometimes we see that it's far out. And we see here that, well, the mean, I can't write on the wall, of course. The mean is around here. This is 1 standard deviation more, and this is maybe 2 standard deviations more. But this one is 2 standard deviations away from this particular mean. While, let me see if I find another example. Well, this absolute distance might be less, but because they are so close together, such a small sigma value, that this might be 4, 5, 6 standard deviations away. So although this blue dot is closer to the two red lines, it's still worse in terms of what the user was doing than actually here. And in this case, even worse, these two red dots are even closer together and this one is even further away. So looking at this, I would say that the blue probe is probably from another person than the one with the red reference. In order to not have this subscript for duration and latency, I just can say I have 2n plus 1 mean and standard deviation, and I have 2n plus 1 timing values in the probe. Yeah, and then in the scale Manhattan distance, we calculated what I expected and what I saw.
what I expected from the reference and what I saw in the template divided by the standard deviation. And I calculate that for each of these 2n plus 1 values. And now this I call this delta I. Delta I is in principle a measure of how many standard deviations the measurement ti is away from the expected value mu I. Is that clear? And assuming that these values should be normally distributed, that will give me an indication of how good or how bad this particular measurement was, this particular timing value, whether it's duration or latency, it doesn't matter. And so the scale Manhattan distance, what we just defined before, I can define it in this way also. It's the sum of these delta i's. Nothing new there. There we have it again. But I want to define another distance metric. In principle, I can say, I can count how often a person makes a mistake. I can say if my probe value is within, let's say, 2 standard deviations away from the mean, I say, oh yeah, that's good, that's what I expect. 95% of my measurement should be within 2 standard deviations. Yeah, so that's okay. If it's further away than 2 standard deviations, yeah, that's just in 5% of the cases. So I count that as an error. And so what I'll do is I'll define delta I. And say if this measurement, small delta I, this capital delta I, this small delta I, if small delta I is less than 2, then apparently my measurement was within 2 standard deviations of the mean. I say that's what I expect. I don't add anything to the distance. If I notice that it is more than that, it's further away, I say that's strange. I count that as an error. And so I set this capital delta I to 1. And so in principle, what I'm doing here in this distance metric, it's just counting how often I am outside this range of what I expect. I expect 95% of the cases to be within this, and so I count how often I'm not within that range. Clear? Yeah? So that could be a distance metric. Which one performs better, this one or this one? I have no idea. You have to test that on your data set again. This might be very rough, because you have errors and you have errors, capital E. So maybe I'll say that if this value, the value that I measure here is less than 2, I say, okay, that's what I expected. 95% should be in there. But if it's somewhere between 2 and 3, I say, yeah, that's still acceptable. Still 4.7% extra, which it should be in that range, between 95 and 99.7. Yeah, so if it would be between 2 and 3, I'll say, okay, then this capital delta I define as 1. But if it's outside, that's odd. That's really odd. Then my delta I could be 4, 3, whatever. Doesn't need to be 2. I can just pick whatever I want. So I can make this more, I can have more granularity in this range. Yeah, and in principle, I can come up with other distance metrics what you want. This one, in general, works very well. Doesn't mean that it is always the best. How about typing errors? My password is welcome 42, and I type welcome 5. Oh, wrong. I backspace the 5, and I type 42. If I do that now in my username password system, I will get access. No problem. But how about if I do that in a keystroke dynamic system? So in total, I typed the password welcome 42. I had the correct password. But if you look, in the keystroke dynamic system, I look at the durations of all these keys, and I look at all the latencies between every pair of keys. But what I just did, all of a sudden, I don't have this latency between the E and the 4 anymore. Yes, I released the E, and then I did something in between, and then I pressed the 4. So in principle, I can calculate the latency between the E and the 4. But that value, as you will imagine, is meaningless. Doesn't represent my normal way of typing at all. So how do I handle that? I can tell you how it's handled in research so far. It's not accepted. This attempt, although you have the correct password, was rejected. You have to type it correct in one go. Not correct at the end, in one go.
So how can we compensate? Because I have still I have a lot of values, I'm just missing one latency. So how can we compensate for that? Well, here is one way. What if in my distance calculation, I just look at durations? That's great, because latencies anyway, that's they have a higher sigma value, so they're all over the place anyway. So I just look at durations. Even if I make typing errors, every time that I make a typing correction, I'm killing off a latency, not a duration. I have typed my password in the end. I have all the characters in there. I have typed. So I have a duration of all of them. So if I use only durations, I'm home free, right? But obviously, if I include latencies in my distance metric, I get a better performance, or I can get a better performance. What if we substitute, we say, okay, I try to calculate that. Yeah, but I get a meaningless value there. Because actually this value that I wanted to calculate is no longer there. The value that I could calculate is meaningless. Yeah, so this, if I calculate this, this will probably be a huge value. Which is great if it's an imposter, because then it would have a huge distance score at the end. Yeah, but if it's me, then I probably don't like that. So what I could do is say, okay, I'm not looking at this per se, I will have a maximum there. If this is 25, I don't calculate with that, I'll just give it a maximum of 4 or whatever. Yeah, everything more than 4 standard deviations away, I'll just cut off at 4. That's a possibility. Yeah, so yeah, I did something wrong, but I can still continue. I can just say, okay, I was expecting, k latencies. I just only found k minus 1. So I'll calculate the sum of these k minus 1 distances based on the latencies, the separate ones. And then I multiply by k divided by k minus 1. So dividing by k minus 1 means I calculate the average distance contribution for each of the latencies. And then multiplying by k is because I need k of them in the end. That's why I'm scaling up. I'll say the one that was missing, I'll represent by the average of all the other latencies. That, in a rare case, could give an attacker a bit of an advantage. Yeah? Suppose that I know your password, I know it's welcome42, and I can mimic it almost completely, except that latency between the E and the 4. I can't do that. I can't get that right. Because I can't get that right, I always get a high distance score and I never get in. Yeah, then if you would have this solution, I'll just make a typing correction there. I'll type welcome 5 backspace 42. Yeah, so then the system would say, okay, that latency is missing, which I would mess up anyway. And I would be replaced by the average of all latencies, which I could copy fairly easy. And so, but that's very rare. How would it be that I can copy everything except one latency? That would be odd, right? But in principle, it will give a way for the user. All of these, well, not so much this one, but these two gave pretty decent performance. You know that Christoph talked about false match rate, false non-match rate, which is a algorithm error. And he talked about false accept, false reject rate. If the typing correction would be rejected as being not corrected once, that would be included as a failure to capture. And so the false accept or false reject rate would be influenced. System error. Yeah? If you use this particular one of these particular methods, then actually the false accept rate, false reject rate would be at the same level as before. Without annoying the user. Because it's more annoying for a user to be asked to type it again while you know that you typed the password correct. Another solution is somebody typed welcome 5. Oh, that was not correct. But when I type welcome 5, what I probably do is move my hand towards the 4. Except that I press slightly too early or too late, well, my finger is not above the 5 but above the 4. Sorry, the other way around. Not above the 4, but above the 5. Yeah, so actually, that latency between E and 5 might be a good replacement for the latency between E and 4, what I wanted to do. But this could also be a solution. I haven't tested that one yet, but could be a solution. Okay, let's have a short 10-minute break, and then we'll continue with typing mimicking. Any questions so far? Yeah?
Practical applications is limited here. I think maybe for signing into or typing a password on one specific computer, it's okay. Most things I type passwords on, I type both on my several different computer keyboards, on small Bluetooth iPad keyboards, on my cell phone.
Yeah.
And sometimes I write the password with both hands, but sometimes I have the coffee cup in my right hand and I write it with the left hand.
Yeah, I totally agree on all of those points. So there is a... the circumstances play a major role here when you do keystroke dynamics, when you do behavior in general. You're now doing your term paper on gait. If you have different shoes, if you're walking on normal shoes or you're wearing flip-flop, it will change your behavior. That the same holds for keystroke dynamics, the same holds for any behavioral biometric. So that's the downside of behavioral biometrics. But hopefully after we have heard all the time purpose, we can say something about how, for example, the change of keyboard influences. There has been research where there was a laptop keyboard and a desktop keyboard, and actually the best performance was when enrolling with one keyboard and testing with the other keyboard. Not sure which one was for the probe and which one was for the reference, that I don't know, I have to look up that detail, but yeah, a cross keyboard apparently still worked. Yeah, having a cup of coffee, that will change your typing completely. If you use a computer or a tablet, yeah, on a tablet you need a different profile. That will be different, certainly. Yeah.
You can have a system that takes a new probe for each.
Yeah. Exactly. Device. That should be, you should do something like that. Yeah. Okay. You had a question?
What about not completely the way you actually use, but how you use, for instance, if you are to write a capital letter, mm-hmm. someone uses shift, but there are persons that actually use the caps lock, write one letter, and then use the caps lock again.
If I
did that, you should throw me out. But is that included in the keystroke dynamics in any manner? Or if you type a word wrong, do you remove the entire word, or you just backspace, stuff like that, is it measured in
research so far? That has been not considered.
Okay.
Yeah, people, if there was a capital, people were instructed to use the shift key.
Okay.
I have in fact seen this use of the caps lock. I wasn't aware of that until we did research here on, I forgot what exactly it was, but all of a sudden we saw that a lot of people were using caps lock, key, caps lock, instead of... Yeah, I never read it. So you did that?
No.
Oh, you didn't do that. Okay, good.
I just...
Thanks.
I saw a person do that, and I thought that would be...
Was he foreign? Was he Indian?
No.
Okay.
Norwegian.
Okay. So, apparently people do that, and you have to figure a way around. If you would do that consistently, then your template would be the duration of the caps lock, the latency between caps lock and A, and so that would be included, so that would not be a big deal. But otherwise, if you would mix between them, then the system should ignore this information.
Okay.
Yeah. So then it's like not using all the features.
Okay.
Yeah?
So that's not measured today.
It's not been used so far as I know.
Okay.
As far as I know. Yeah. Okay. Good. Let's have a short break and then I have the last part. typing mimicking. So we are looking at, can I mimic the behavior of somebody? If we are looking at biometrics, talking about spoofing, what we often try to do is fool a sensor. We are using some kind of fake fingerprints, rubber fingerprints that we put on a finger and then on a sensor. So we really are trying to spoof the sensor, fool the sensor. It's what is called presentation attack. In behavioral biometrics, we're trying to copy behavior of somebody. Yeah, so if people are walking, we're trying to walk like somebody else, which in some cases can be very difficult. So we have to really watch what somebody is doing and then try to mimic that. Obviously, if mimicking would be very easy, then keystroke dynamics is not useful at all. If I can look at you and see how you type a password, and if I can steal your password in some way, and I can just copy the typing rhythm, yeah, then it's all useless. So what we did here many years ago already is testing how difficult it is. And then we gave some feedback to the attacker. And the feedback that the attacker got was either yes, no, get access or not. You get a score, okay, the distance between the probe and the reference and your probe is so much, or we gave full feedback. So let's see what that means. So yes, no is actually like in a normal system. Yeah, my system is using keystroke dynamics for the password, static keystroke dynamics, and somebody is sitting behind it trying to type like me, we assume that he has a password, and he gets access or he doesn't get access. So the typing was same as my typing, or it wasn't. Like in a real system, right? If the attacker doesn't get access, then apparently he's not typing the way that I'm typing. So he has to change his typing behavior. But how? He doesn't know. He just has to randomly try something. And if he tried something and he didn't get access, did he actually make things worse? Or did he make things better? He has no idea. No idea of knowing. So in this case, the best strategy for an attacker is just try as many times as possible in different ways, possibly, until at some point you get access, and then try to remember what you just did when you got access and try to learn that way to get off more often access. But from typing the password now and not getting access, I have no information at all. Typing it again and not getting access, I have no information about the relation between the two. In case the system was implemented wrong and it displays a message that, oh, sorry, you didn't get access because the keystroke dynamics only had this distance score. Oh, that's great, because now I learned something. I have no idea what I'm doing wrong and I have to make random changes, but once I make a random change, I look at the new score. And at the very least, I can say that I improved my way of typing more like the victim or not. And so if I'm making a random change and I notice that the distance gets better, the distance score gets better, well, I'll keep that. Try to change something else, I'll try to change it even more. Maybe I typed a bit faster and I type even more fast. Yeah, but if it's getting the wrong way, okay, what I just did, I'll forget. I'll go back to the old situation and try another change. So here, again, the best strategy is to make random changes because I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I know that I'm wrong, but I just make a random change. And if it's a good change, I'll keep it. If it's a bad change, I'll forget about it. But how about the full feedback? In the full feedback, we must assume that somehow the attacker got access to the template of the user. So somehow I know how you type your password, everything. In all details. So I have this figure that we saw before. I know where the red lines are. And I see that if I type something, I see my blue line. And so I know exactly what I'm doing wrong. And so I see, okay, my duration of the E is way too long. I might be faster there. And all of these durations are
too long, so I have to type faster. Some of the latencies are, on the other hand, too low. So I may have to wait a bit longer between keys. But I know exactly what to change. And probably I will make changes where the impact is the largest, so I'll make a change here. I'm not changing this one here, for example. It's outside that boundary, but it's just outside. Yeah, it's a bit dependent on the distance metric also, but yeah, so this one doesn't need as much attention as this one. So I know what to do. I know where to make changes. And so that's also my best strategy. Look at what I just did. See where I have to make, where the change has the highest impact, and try to adapt my behavior based on that. And then we notice that, how to read this learning curve is different from the learning curve about learning a new password, but this is related to the three feedbacks and how the attackers improved. If they all started at score 100, you saw that even if you got yes/no information, the user or the attacker was getting used to the password. So in the beginning, also he was not used to the password, a random password, so he was typing unsure. He was getting more fluent, and that made that score drop anyway. Like for the normal user, the victim. Yeah, but at some point it seemed to stabilize. If he got the score information, yeah, he could do a bit better. And when they had a full profile, at some point, could perform the best as an attacker. Does he get access there? Well, we noticed that in general did not really help in getting access to the system. Why is that? Why can't I improve more and more? Because that's what we expect, right? The thing is that if we look at this, there's a lot of complexity here. Okay, just be a bit faster on the E and be a bit slower on the latency, a bit faster on the latency between the E and the N. Try to do that. So in theory, it's easy to see what you have to do. Okay, I'll do one step at a time. I'll just be faster on the E. Yeah, shorter on the duration of the E. Yeah? And once I get the hang of that, I can see if I can make other changes. Okay, once I got that, then I will be faster on the, the Z. Yeah? Shorter on the duration of the Z. But once I start focusing on that, my natural behavior will kick in again here, and I will lose here. So we saw that people were focusing on one thing, and then when they changed to something else, the focus on that first thing went away. We haven't only seen it in keystroke dynamics, we have seen it in gait recognition also. If I try to adapt too much of my behavior, I can't cope with that anymore. And some of these things that I tried to change before will fall back to the normal behavior again. So that's why even when I have full access to somebody's profile, I still can't be perfect. There's some other research where they use two passwords. Sarn Dele and THS.OUR2. They used those two passwords because I said the first one was easy and the second one was difficult. Not sure if you agree with that. Did I see this password? This is our. I can write both words. So I didn't see it as completely random or very difficult. Anyway, they had they had different experiments, and they had a number of attackers and a number of victims. And each attacker was assigned to a random victim. And the feedback they gave was visual. So you have to think a bit about this. The dots are durations, and the bars are latencies. And I think the blue one is what the victim is doing. Was that the case? Or the other way around, doesn't really matter. And the green and the red ones were what the attacker was doing, and green indicated that was okay, and red indicated that changes were needed. So here you see a large difference, that this one is red, and so I have to make a change here. I have to make a change here, but this duration, don't need to pay attention to. And so they had a graphical representation. I could see these numerical values. Again, it's a huge amount of information that at some point becomes too much. However,
they based upon what you have as the as your distance metric, and what you allow as a threshold for a distance score to be accepted or not, you can get access or not. Anyway, their conclusion was that mimicking was possible, and the easier the password, the easier it is to mimic the password. Why? Because CERN, S-E-R-N-D-E-L-E, that's probably baked in more easy, because it's just the number of letters, and we are very much used to typing these letters. Yeah, once we get into using a shift key and numbers and periods, it gets a bit more difficult. Some attackers, this is one of the reasons why I'm not really trusting what they're saying, some of these attackers were accepted 100% of the time, which is odd, because me as a genuine user, I am not getting accepted 100% of the time. So how come an attacker is accepted 100% of the time? That's a bit odd. Anyway, that was their results. We had an experiment with two passwords, welcome 42, which is easy, and capital AIDU 50 capital XV, which is supposed to be a bit harder. And we noticed that indeed it was easier to mimic this password than to mimic that password. So this part of their conclusions was at the very least confirmed. That is when all of this, what I talked about, is when a human tries to sit behind a computer and tries to mimic the behavior. This is one step further. We have a robot that is actually, I'm typing as an attacker on this keyboard. There's a computer in here that will translate the typing behavior of me to the typing behavior of the victim, and then this robot, which has pins, it will press on the keys on the keyboard that is attached to the victim's computer. Yeah?
If you have the data set, then you could just put it in a rubber ducky and...
Yeah. Actually, we have a master student at the moment working with this, with the robot, but the robot isn't working completely as he wanted, and so he's going over to use USB rubber ducky. So we build a robot, or we had a robot built by bachelor students, just for the visual effect. Because if I put a USB in the system, you can't see anything. And at the very least, you could see here the keys move, and you visually could see what was happening. But the idea is exactly the same. So that much for mimicking. And obviously, if I start using a machine, be it this robot or be it USB rubber ducky, obviously I can attack much better than trying to mimic the behavior as a human. Let's talk about language-related issues. You are all Norwegian. So if you type in Swedish or Danish, is that difficult? Does that change your typing behavior? Or not?
Probably.
I mean, the languages, certainly Danish is very much alike. Yeah, Swedish might be slightly different. What if you type in English? Do you notice yourself a typing difference if you type a Skype message to a Norwegian friend, or a formal report in a Skype message to me, for example, in English? Huh? How about if I would ask you to type in Finnish or Hungarian? Actually, those two are in the same language group, together with Basque, but there's no connection between these three languages. They were just three singletons that they just put together. That's all. Finnish, yeah, you have seen Finnish yourself already before, I'm assuming. It's completely different. Hungarian, again, is completely different. French or Spanish, you might have had that in Ungdomsskole or Videregående Skole, so you might remember something. And if you learned Spanish, yeah, you might recognize some words in French also. Maybe I should have put Italian here. So there are languages that are related. And you probably do equally good or bad, whatever you want to call it, in those languages. What if I would add Indonesian or Filipino? Again, these languages have a very completely different structure than what you would expect. So here we have a Norwegian sentence. I wasn't sure. Is it dette or that? The first word. Dette. So this is great. Okay, good. All of this is Google Translate, by the way. This is not my doing. And I translated from this English sentence. But you see that these are similar. And so sure, there will be a slight difference if I type saddening or saddening. Yeah, so there will be a slight difference. Because you're used to typing saddening, and all of a sudden you have to replace the second letter there. Yeah? But probably the typing rhythm will not change extremely. Probably you're used to English enough to be fluent in that one also, and you don't notice a huge difference in typing English or Norwegian. For me, at least, if I type in Dutch or in English, there's no difference. When I type in Norwegian, I have to think too much about the Norwegian itself, about the grammar, that the typing rhythm will be different. But if I would do it more, probably it wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, the Finnish sentence, all of a sudden there is no relation to what I've seen before. And none of these words look like anything else. And I'm getting these accents also in Spanish. Oh, sorry, Hungarian. I'm getting accents and I get words and letter combinations that I'm completely unfamiliar with. Yeah, French. If you had to, who knows French? But you had it in Wiedergrund or in Jungdomsschule, yeah? So yeah, okay, maybe some of that is still hanging around there in a few. Yeah, here, probably what you do is you look at this word and you type a few letters and then you have to look at the word again. Probably if you see this, you can write a part before you have to look at the sentence again. Spanish, okay, for those who had Spanish in Jungdomsschule or Wiedergrundschule. That should not be too hard. Yeah, you can write longer parts of the sentence. Indonesian. Again, completely different. Filipino. Yeah, I can't make any chocolate of that. Yeah, and then I did not include a language where you have a lot of different accents, not on the letters itself, but outside that. So Hawaiian is. Yeah, kind of odd. And I didn't include any different kind of layout of characters. Yeah, Chinese simplified apparently. This is not too hard. Yeah. Going from one language to another is a major task. Your typing rhythm will change extremely. So how can we use that? Because that's what we want. Actually, you as Norwegians, if you type a Norwegian sentence, I might not be able to distinguish between the five of you. But if I would type it, I would type it in a much different way than you would. If we all typed in English, it might be more common. So actually going over to Norwegian is a good thing, because at the very least you can rule out me as a potential attacker. So that was the idea that we had. So we did that in not in static authentication, static keystroke dynamics, but in challenge-based keystroke dynamics. So we had participants from seven different language regions, and each participant typed 60 English words and 10 English sentences. The regions were Norwegian, Hindi, Telugu. These are both from India, so there is an overlap between the languages. Czech, Spanish, Hungarian, and Slovak. And there were 10 participants per region, except for Hindi. We did only get 6, 7, 8, I don't recall how many, but we didn't get enough participants there, unfortunately. Each participant typed 60 English words. All these English words could be used as a password. They were between 8 and 12 characters long, regular English words. From a dictionary list, we had a list of 100, and we selected 60 at random. So each participant got its own list of 60 words. And the sentences, those were fixed. Everybody got the same sentences, between 33 and 50 characters long, including the spaces. But if you excluded the spaces, you got between 27 and 42 letters, A to Z.
Yeah? So that's what where we started. This was used for the baseline. Yeah, if I know if we can, if we have a common baseline with English words, so how would we then perform if we go over to our own language? So again, each participant typed 60 words in his own language. Again, 8 to 12 characters, same as in English. 60 words from a random list of 100 words, and only A to Z was used. So the nice Norwegian word chauffeur was not included because, yeah, the Norwegians could type it, they had it on their keyboard, but somebody in Spain could not type that. Besides that, you as Norwegian had to type 60 Norwegian words, you also had to type 10 words in 7 foreign languages. 10 words per foreign language. Again, 8 to 12 characters, same as before, A to Z only, and selected from a list, again, that same list of 100 words for that particular language. I'll just select 10 because it was not your general language. And these were the languages. Norwegian, Hindi, Telugu, Czech, Spanish, Hungarian, Slovak, and French. Although there were no French participants, we added French as a language that was not the first languages of any of these participants. So that was the setup. So we first we created the template based on, or we created two types of templates. One based on English words that I typed, and one based on my own language. Yeah? Norwegian for you, Hindi for the Indian people, etc. Based on 50 words. So of my list of 60 English words that I typed, I used the first 50 to create a reference, and then the 10 last were used as probes. And the same for my own language, because I had 60, I could use 50 for the template and 10 for the probes. On average, a word is 10 characters long. Yeah, between 8 and 12, I said. And I'm not sure if this exactly holds, but anyway, it will be close. If I have 50 words of 10 characters long, that means that in the end, when I'm calculating the reference, I have 500 durations available, because every word has 10 durations, and I have 50 of them. And I have 450 latencies available, because I have just 9 latencies for each of the 50 words. So that means that if I look at durations, I have 26 different letters. And they are not spread equally, of course, but on average, that means I see every value 19.2 times. The E I see much more often, the N I see much more often, the J I see very little. But you see that I have a sufficient number of information. If I look at latencies, because I'm looking at pairs of letters from AA, AB, AC, all the way to ZZ, I have 26 times 26 different combinations, and only 450. So on average, I see everything just 0.7 times. Probably, JQ will not be in there. And TH will occur more often, ND will occur more often, IN will occur more often. Yeah, but you'll see that for the latencies, we are in a bad situation. The durations, okay, I can build some statistics, certainly on a number of letters, maybe not all, but on a number of letters I can build statistics. For the latencies, it will be a problem. So how did we solve that? We were not calculating all of these latencies anymore between two letters. So what we did is we split the keyboard into regions. So first we split it into left-right, keys that I type with the left hand, keys that I type with the right hand, and yes, they should be blue, because that's my right hand to the letter, right? That's a typo here. And then a latency would then be a letter type with the left hand, and the next letter type with the left hand, or a letter type with the left hand, and the next with the right hand, or right and then left, or right and then right. So I just had four different kind of latencies. Wasn't going anymore from AA to ZZ. But it didn't matter if I type ER or if I type AS, that is both left-left latency. Yeah? So typing two letters, two consecutive letters with one hand, it was considered more difficult than switching between hands. Because if I switch between hands, I can position my other hand already while I'm typing one letter, and then it's easier. Yeah, if I have to use one hand, it might be more difficult. That was the idea behind it. Same with this split. Upper, middle, lower, yeah? Depending on if I have to type two letters on the upper row, yeah, my finger is there already. I can do it easier. If I have to switch between this from the upper to the lower, yeah, then probably the latency will be different. That was a theory.
So latency, when I now talk about latency, it's either the left-right latency or the upper-middle-lower latency. So we did first create a baseline. What if we just use English? Because I want to see the influence of language, and so I have to have a starting point. So the starting point was we used the English reference template and the English words as probes. And we noticed that the best performance was gotten when we used a scaled Manhattan distance, when we only considered durations, and the performance is not good because everything is the setup wasn't optimal. The performance, the EER was 0.25. But actually, if you would have included latencies in this particular case, so the rest is the same. We have the scaled Manhattan distance, and then we use just the left-right latencies, you get a very high, almost 0.4. And if you use upper-middle-lower latencies, oh, again, 0.4. If you start combining that with durations or all three kinds of features, and you got these. Very high, very big difference between just durations and also including or just having latency features. That didn't just hold for this distance metric. We used Manhattan distance, scaled Manhattan distance, Euclidean distance, and scaled Euclidean distance. Those were the four that we used. Then we said, yeah, if you try to log on with just a single word, 8 to 12 characters, that's not a lot of information. So what if I use a longer sentence? What if I start using the sentences to log on? So I still have the same reference, which was based on the first 50 English words, but I'm trying, as probe, I used the 10 English sentences. So I got some more information. Indeed, the distance metric, the performance went down, the ER went down. Yeah, but it's still a huge step from just using durations to also including or just using latencies. So that first is an indication that, at the very least, the way that we define these latencies is not a smart way. Then we went on to looking at the language experiment. So everybody has typed 60 words in his own language. What if I create 50 words from the first 50 words, a reference template, and then use the other 10 words to do the testing? And there was a group of 10 Norwegians. They all have a template, a Norwegian template. And there was a group of 10 Spanish who all had a Spanish template. But everybody, all of the participants, typed Spanish words. Also the Spanish. They had 60 words, 60 Spanish words. So 50 was used for the template. And the remaining 10 could be used as probes. But also the Norwegians had typed Spanish words. So everybody typed whatever person you try to mimic, whatever language group you were from, you always had some probes to test that. And we found that the performance depended very much on the language. So here, for Norwegian, for the 10 Norwegian users, they had a Norwegian template. We noticed that the best performance was, yeah, around here. Either scaled Euclidean distance with only durations, or scaled Manhattan distance where they have durations and the left-right latencies. Now those are very close together, these numbers. But you see that all the other numbers in this table are also close. So there is not a big gap between the best and the rest. All of a sudden, the latencies as we define them didn't seem like that strange of a choice. At least for Norwegian. That is the Norwegians again. So this is the Czech template, the Czech user group. Again, we have a best performance up here, scaled Manhattan distance and duration, which we'll see a lot. And yeah, all the others are within range of that. That is Slovak. Best performance 20%. Well, now we are really getting better than the just English template, right? And again, all the others are in the same neighborhood. That doesn't hold anymore for the Telugu, where you have now a much better performance, 18, slightly over 0.18.
for scaled or for scaled Euclidean or scaled Manhattan distance using only duration. But you again see that all the other values, when I include the latencies, all of a sudden these are very high again. That's the Hungarians, with again slightly below 0.2 as the best performance. And then we have the Spanish, where initially I thought that this was the best performance. But now, very strangely, if you look here, 0.17 almost. Lowest of all values. And all of a sudden, not a scaled distance, but just the Euclidean distance, and including all durations, both types of latency. We have no good explanation for that as of yet. So suggestions are welcome. But anyway, that is what we noticed. These are the results that we got. We didn't try to optimize the performance. We just used simple Euclidean and Manhattan distance and simple scaled Euclidean scaled Manhattan distance. Not much more. We didn't try to find the optimal type of latency or whatever type of features that we could use. Just as is. Just simple as a first to show that there is an influence of the language. Notice that for Czech, actually the best performance is worse than just using English, which is off. We noticed that performance increases, except for Czech then, that if you use specific language-specific challenges instead of just English challenges. If I use more characters, so the English sentences, then the performance will be better. Probably if I use longer native language sentences, the performance would even be better. Performance depends highly on the language. And duration features in general will give good results. But what other features? We were not sure about. Maybe we should also have looked at just a total type of time of typing a word. Yeah, but that's does not exclude somebody really studying the word first and then starting to type at once from memory. Yeah, that probably exclude people who start typing and then continuing looking. Yeah, then it's clear that your total duration will be longer. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to say about the language specific things. By the applications, I don't want to say that much. There is in Blackboard, you will see a mandatory paper, reading paper. It's an overview paper of keystroke dynamics. They have at the very end also a number of companies that they mention that are into keystroke dynamics. BioPassword was one of the first companies in this area. They didn't exist anymore, but they were apparently taken over or changed the name to AdmitOne Security, which is no longer available either. Then there are some, another US company, but BehaviorTech is a Swedish company. I think it's a spin-off from Luleå University. They are in Luleå at least. But they are more into continuous authentication. Another number of, there's mostly is US, but some French, Dutch, UK we also found. Siloc is a German company. I saw a reference in a 2009 academic paper, but the company is no longer in existence, apparently. And then in the paper from Banerjee, they mentioned Scout Analytics, and they said, oh, look, they are from the same place as AdmitOne Security, but the fact that AdmitOne Security is no longer existent makes me believe that they have gone over into Scout Analytics. But looking at their website, I couldn't really quickly find anything about keystroke dynamics. What I did find was another company, KeyTrack, and they say a bit more about the typing behavior. And they have also, in fact, challenge-based authentication. So you can just play a bit around there. You can type two text, I don't know, about 50 to 100 characters, I don't know how long they are, two sentences. And then from that, the system can learn how you type, and if you type a new sentence, it will recognize you.
And I tried to type in different ways, but still recognized me. Only when I went over from two hands to one finger typing, it didn't recognize me anymore. So I think if I used one hand typing, it was still rather fluent, and it still recognized me with a lower score, but it still recognized me. So just go and see if you can try that too. So that was actually the last slide, which means that for once I really end up really on time. Any questions? That's good. So either I was very clear or very unclear. Okay, well then, thanks for being here. And then I will see you again next week.